Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I want to welcome back our great guest co-host, Dr. Michael Baca-Atlas. Welcome, Michael.
Thanks for having me on the show again, Adam.
We're on our show today. We're going to be talking with some really interesting entrepreneurs and co-founders of a company called My Health Ed. We'll be talking with Liz Chin and Vichy Jagannathan about Real Talk, the company's new app that uses teens' phones as a tool to tackle hard topics like sexuality. I'm really, really fascinated.
Very much looking forward to that.
Yeah. But we first have some interesting research that matters. So let's dive right in. Our very first one is about youth football. We've been talking about football for the last year or two, a lot of research, correct?
Yeah, and it's been in the media quite a bit lately. And so, you know, Adam, this is really interesting. This actual study entitled Youth Football Tied to Emotional Issues in Adulthood actually steers away from the common conversation regarding concussions and actually looks at how football may be impacting and contributing to depression, apathy, and other behavioral issues later in life.
So this was research that was actually in Nature's Translational Psychiatry Journal, and it was 214 men, half of whom had started playing football before age 12 and the rest after age 12. 43 actually played through high school and 103 played through college. So a pretty select group because not that many actually play in college who've played youth football. And they even had some that played professionally in this group. And the men were 51 at the time of the study. And what did they actually find?
So this is interesting. This is really interesting conversation starter, but there are really some limitations related to the study. Essentially, what they showed is that those who started playing younger demonstrated a twofold increase in risk for apathy and behavioral regulation and a threefold increase in risk for depression than those who started playing later. Now, Adam, however, a few limitations with this study. Participants actually chose to take part in this study rather than being chosen at random. And the retrospective nature of the study, looking backwards, didn't really take into account rule changes related to youth football, including limits on full contact practices and more aggressive coaching on proper tackling techniques.
It does raise the question, though, if it were true and playing football before age 12, if you knew as a parent that it was going to have some adverse psychological impacts later in life, one would really have some cause. So I think this is a warning sign. It's a warning sign for better research and more longitudinal research. But I think as a parent, I might have some real conversations.
Absolutely. This goes into the pile with some additional research that we already know.
Let's talk about our next research that matters, Michael, and it's about resistance exercise and anxiety. Do you do any resistance exercise? You know, we're talking about some weights here where you're, you know, those bands that they sell on TV that you can pull back against resistance, but, you know, obviously to build some muscle. You ever do that?
I do, and you clearly do. Just watching you demonstrate those movements there, you're a pro.
Well, you must not have seen that I don't do it as frequently as they recommend in this particular article. But the question is, why do people do those? And can they actually, in addition to making people feel better, which is why I think a lot of people do it, can it make them be less anxious? Ah, interesting question.
Really interesting study. So researchers looked at 16 previously published studies with a total of 922 participants, and resistance workouts were associated with a reduction in anxiety symptoms, regardless of whether or not participants had a mental health disorder. The interesting part about this analysis, Adam, is that they didn't compare these results to aerobic exercise, which we know has certain benefits related
right.
to anxiety.
Right, but they did say that the effect size, how much it worked, was about the same as you might see with some medications and psychotherapy. That, to me, is really fascinating. And it suggests that we have an additional tool. It's not an expensive tool. There's not a lot of consequences. So I must say, every time I go to do my resistance training, usually on vacation when I haven't done it for 6 months, and that very first day, I do too much, and I get really, really sore muscles. We shouldn't do too much too soon.
Absolutely. And so choosing an enjoyable workout really makes sense, something that people and patients can participate in. And the people that were involved in these resistance exercises performed these 2 to 5 days per week, and that was looked at over approximately 12 weeks.
I think this is a good news for those who are in the gym business. We like it. Speaking about our next research that matters, this is something that's a little more difficult. And I'm sure we have lots of listeners out there who are taking aspirin, possibly prescribed by their doctor. Maybe they're taking it because they think it helps their overall heart health and lowers the risk of a heart attack. But what about those who've stopped it for some reason?
Yeah, I hadn't seen any research related to this before, Adam. And so stopping low-dose aspirin, according to a large Swedish study that was published in Circulation, raised the likelihood of a heart attack or stroke by nearly 40%.
Yeah, that to me is shocking. It doesn't get into fully understanding why people stopped these, and that may have some impact. I mean, this was actually looking at records of 600,000 patients who had been taking aspirin really pretty regularly. They did exclude those who maybe had severe bleeding, but what we don't know is how many people probably couldn't take it for other reasons. Maybe they just had chronic gastritis, ulcers, other things that didn't have severe bleeding but were a problem. And those people may have been the right people that didn't need it, but there's others that probably needed the aspirin and didn't take it. Should give some cause for additional conversation.
Absolutely. I think shared decision-making is key, specifically related to aspirin.
Yeah. So talk with your doctor both about, are you really indicated to start taking an aspirin? But then if you are, the risk associated with stopping it. Talking about other research, and our very last research that matters has to do with, we're approaching and will be in for the next several months, flu season. And is there anything that we could do that could lower our risk of the flu? What do you think, Mike?
Yeah, Adam, this is published in the Journal of Leukocyte Biology, which I know you read
regularly. Almost every other year.
And the reason that this article stuck out to me was that this was published by the University of Maryland School of Medicine, my alma mater.
Must be good.
Must be excellent and very relevant. And so what they showed, Adam, is they looked at animal models and showed that there was a specific molecule that helped to decrease inflammatory cytokines, and I think and molecules that promote inflammation related to the flu. And those who had this particular substance inhibited showed less severe symptoms and had decreased mortality compared to the control group. And so I think that although this may be a ways away, that there may be some therapeutic options in the future.
Inflammatory cytokines.
Yeah, say that 10 times fast.
Well, that sounds like a good football team name. The inflammatory cytokines. We're looking forward to that research. We do want you to get your flu shot. If you haven't, we do want you to ensure that you stay as healthy as possible during flu season. Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We'll take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with the co-founders of MyHealthEd, Liz Chin and Vichy Jagannathan, about Real Talk, the company's new app that uses teen phones as a tool to tackle hard topics. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Michael Baca Atlas. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's #2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Michael Baca Atlas. Today on Conversations, Michael, we're talking with the co-founders of MyHealthEd, Liz Chin and Vichy Jagannathan, about Real Talk, the company's new app that uses teens' phones as a tool to tackle hard topics. Welcome to Your Health.
Welcome, Liz and Vichy, to the show today.
Thank you for having us.
Oh, it's great to have you here. And, you know, one of the things that Michael and I like to really understand when we get started is a little bit about the people involved who are on the show talking about things that are really important. And you're going to be talking about some really important items relating to very difficult conversations to have with teens. But first off, we want to know a little bit more about you. You all look, for our listeners, very young, and I think you are very young, which separates you from the great majority of our guests. Tell us about yourselves.
So I am from outside of Boston, Massachusetts. I hail from Westwood, which is a suburb, and went to Princeton for undergrad, which is actually where Vici and I met for the first time. And we were fortuitously placed in neighboring classrooms through Teach for America in Northampton County back in 2010 and 2011. And so the two of us made up the science department at our rural high school. And through that experience, we met a lot of students and parents and spent a lot of time asking them about their health needs and realized that sex education was not something that was taught at the local high school, but that was strongly desired by teens and also their parents.
What about you, Vici?
And so, yeah, just to add to that, I grew up just outside of New York City, Poughkeepsie, New York, very suburban. I studied engineering at Princeton, which is where Liz and I kind of met, but didn't necessarily work closely together, and then were very fortuitously and randomly assigned to neighboring classrooms. And I think one of the things that struck me the most was the level of disparity between urban and rural in America. I had never really lived in a rural community, certainly not in the South, and was surprised by things like just extremely high rates of teen pregnancy in our schools. I think close to 1 in 5 of our female students were pregnant at one point in high school, and it was just something I'd never seen before. So did move away a little bit after Teach for America, but have never really been able to forget the experiences and the parents and families that we met in rural North Carolina, and so I'm really excited to be back to work on this problem more locally.
And we're excited, too.
And with those experiences that you both had, how did it culminate to an app?
That's a great question. Vici and I have actually been in the sex ed world for the past 4 years, and we initially started with an online sex education course for high school students. And what we realized from that experience was that it still hinged upon a school district or a teacher reaching out to us to provide that resource to students. And so they were still acting as the middleman. And we realized that that wasn't the case for a lot of our students having access to teachers who were reaching out for these additional resources. And so after realizing that many of our students have smartphones, that we decided to go straight to teens directly on their smartphones. And we made the conscious decision to go from high school to middle school, mostly because in the areas that we work with in Eastern North Carolina, a good proportion of our students do initiate sexual intercourse prior to transitioning to high school.
So what do we know about sex education for students? I mean, it's interesting. We think about science and we think about biology and chemistry, and it'd be hard to think that a student gets through middle school or high school without being exposed to fundamental issues that are important to leading a life as a citizen. But it seems with sex education, I suspect that a large number of schools, both rural and urban, don't do very much. Is that the case or not? What do we know?
From what we've found, we have worked primarily with the rural districts in Eastern North Carolina. We have not seen a lot of our schools spend money on curricular resources for this. And so we know that they're already tight with budgets for everything else that they do, that oftentimes health and some of the arts courses are severely underfunded. But many school leaders still actually don't realize that North Carolina has really great sex education standards for 7th, 8th, and 9th graders. And it is comprehensive per the Healthy Youth Act of 2009. But getting training in these standards and then having the money to put towards resources is both expensive and also timely. And so this is why I think we are also really committed to bringing resources directly to teens on their phones.
And so you have this idea for this app, and you're presenting this to potentially a school, to parents. I imagine that that could be construed as somewhat controversial. And what kind of barriers have there been in trying to implement this?
Honestly, I'd say the response from adults has been largely positive. So one of the things that I think most people tend to agree on is that talking about sex ed is very awkward and uncomfortable. And both adults and children find this conversation to be awkward. So there are quite a few parents that see the app and they're like, oh, yes, I don't have to have this conversation anymore. Or I have this tool that can help me bring this up with my kid. So I think generally speaking, what we've found is that parents, teachers want to have some sort of conversation with their kids about puberty and sex ed and healthy relationships and really don't know how to start it. So more than anything, I think they're grateful that this tool can come to exist.
And as you think about the issues that are facing teens, what do you think you hope is really going to happen over the next few years with the work that you're doing?
I think one of the big outcomes that we're driving for is an increase in the number of conversations that teens have around these different topics, and then also not only improving the frequency that they're having these conversations, but the quality of these conversations. And so we know that having trusted people in your lives, be it parents, teachers, or peers, to talk about these things is really good and builds towards healthier relationships, romantic or non-romantic, in a young adult's life.
Do you have any, at this point, kind of particular stories or things that have come out of the app that have been exciting, whether that's responses from parents or, you know, middle school students who've been using the apps, anything that comes to mind?
I could share some and then Liz, jump in. One of the things that's been fun is sort of in order to develop this app, we went through the human-centered design process. So last year, we had some coaching from IDEO and went through a series of in-depth interviews with kids and then a whole bunch of prototyping sessions where we show them versions of the app to get their feedback. And so at different points, we've been able to see how teens react to the content in the app. And I think one of my favorite things is that almost every kid who uses it says, this app makes me know that I'm not alone. Or it helps me know that other people are going through similar things like me. So there's a surprisingly high level of empathy and community building, I guess, which has been really positive. I don't think that most people's experience with sex ed in the past is anything like that. So that's been at least one thing I'm excited about.
We also collect real stories from real teens to share in our app. And so it's been great to have a lot of teen users send us their own personal stories, ranging from males sharing about their woes with breast buds and stories related to males also feeling the pressure to stay thin. And so these are not the typical narratives that we see every day. And so we're excited to keep collecting stories from real teens so that other teens know that they're not alone in what they're experiencing.
Well, there's a whole bunch of issues that we want to talk about, including this amazing grant that you all received and this opportunities that this makes. And obviously, you're working on things, and so we're going to talk about those challenges, including confidentiality. How do you maintain it? And lots of things I think our listeners will be interested in and we're interested in. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll continue talking with the co-founders of MyHealthEd, Liz Chen and Vichy Yaganathan, about Real Talk, the company's new app that uses teens' phones as a tool to tackle hard topics. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein after Michael Baca-Atlas. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we're talking with the co-founders of MyHealthEd, Liz Chen and Vichy Jagannathan, about Real Talk, the company's new app that uses teens' phones as a tool to tackle hard topics. Prior to the break, we were discussing the app and your guys' experiences and how all of this came to be.
You know, I know you have just released a beta version, kind of going live with the Real Talk and the app. Give us a sense of what it's like. How does a teen in a school setting or out of school setting access this? Would they be aware of it? And what's the experience like when they kind of first get there?
Sure. So since we are really trying to make sure we can reach every teen, one of the things that's, I think, great about Real Talk is that you don't have to access it in school. So one of the things we did, we interviewed hundreds of teens in rural North Carolina and West Texas mostly, and found that literally almost every single one has Instagram on their own phone and checks it every single day. And so a main strategy to reach them has actually been targeted Instagram ads. And so we run ads that kind of have a little snippet of a story, and teens click on that ad. They can now download the beta version of the app. The app is very simple at this point, and the real thing we're trying to maximize for is reading stories. So when a kid logs into Real Talk, they see like one screen. It's a feed of stories from Real Teens about different topics. And the main action is like you can click on a story, read it. From there, there's a bunch of other stories that they're directed to, so they can go pretty deep on single topic, different topics. Right now, there's also the ability to search for topics, and we're pretty interested in seeing what terms that they actually look for. I think eventually we want to think about other ways that users could interact with the stories, but we really want to get the content right first.
Well, and I would be concerned if I were a parent, or concerned because of what I know clinically about abuse of a different population looking at this as entree or an avenue. How do you handle in your work confidentiality or anonymity, or to ensure that the stories are safe for those who are posting them?
Yes. So all the stories are curated through us, and so it's not directly submitted to us, and then it doesn't magically appear in the app immediately. So there is a process where we go through and review the stories, and then we actually have a teen advisory board of middle school students who help us title each of the stories before they appear in the app. But all of the content that we get from Real Teens is de-identified. And so if there are names and places put in, we switch it out for something completely separate. And that protects the users. But we also don't have any way right now for users to interact with other users currently in our beta version. And that was intentional so that we could maintain a safe space for students as we test different hypotheses with how they want to better engage and interact with different features before we build anything new.
And my understanding is that they can respond with an emoji. Do you guys have any plans for further engaging users, or is that kind of the platform that you guys are sticking with for now?
It's really important that we maintain the safety of the space. I think that's probably the most important thing. That being said, we also want to figure out how to allow users to interact with the stories. But I think it's still early in terms of exploring what that might look like and how to make sure that when users go into it, they feel like it's a safe space, they feel protected, and that we're also driving to the goals that we want, which are sort of around communication. So it's a tricky thing, honestly, to maintain a safe online community with users of that age group. So I think we're proceeding cautiously and like planning to continue to use the prototyping and design process we've been using to make sure we're building something that will lead to the goals we want.
You know, you talked about either by design or certainly as a consequence, the building of community, which also brings you into political discussions. And I'm just thinking about the political discussion in the country around transgender and identity and sexual identity. I imagine you have to deal with that in your app. How do you deal with that in your app right now?
We have been asking specifically for stories that have to do with sexual identity and gender identity. And so I think that we were surprised actually with one of the Instagram ads that we ran. It was close to 1 in 3 of the stories that were submitted to us came from a student who identified as LGBTQ, which was much higher than we had anticipated. So we do think that they feel, LGBTQ students who submitted their stories did feel safe in submitting a story, which is encouraging for us. And so we do want to make sure that we are inclusive in the content that we gather and share all of those topics in our app.
Nice.
And Vici, just going back to what you mentioned before about, you know, getting advertisements, obviously you guys are putting a tremendous amount of work and time into this. I would imagine requires a little bit of money. Have you guys received any support thus far, and from who?
Yeah, so our major source of funding is a grant that comes through the National Campaign to Prevent Unplanned and Teen Pregnancy, which is under the Office of Adolescent Health. And so that funding stream is what has largely allowed us to get to this point in development and hopefully for the next couple of months in terms of beta testing and eventually trying to grow. We also have support from the Fast Forward Accelerator. So that was something we participated in this summer in San Francisco, as well as some funding from Innovate Health Yale, which was a grant that I was able to get when I was in business school there, and very recently some support from Google.org. So
it's exciting. It's exciting.
It is.
You are young entrepreneurs that started at this place of undergraduate school, but then finding each other in a rural North Carolina and teach you know. And I wonder, what do you see for the next 6 months? What's your life like? You know, Liz, you're still in graduate school, and you just graduated, but yet you're running a small business. How does that work right now?
It is always an adventure for the two of us and our third co-founder, Christina. I think that we envision spending a lot of time with middle school students in the next 3 months, especially trying to gather their feedback as to what they like and dislike about the current beta version of Real Talk, and then quickly iterating on what we learn to implement new things into the actual app itself. And in addition to that, likely fundraising and finding strategic partners who are willing to pilot test Real Talk either in classroom settings or settings external to schools so that we can reach as many teens as we can in the next 3 months.
Describe for our listeners, how would they go about accessing this app at this point in time?
So the easiest way would be to go into the Apple App Store and search for Real Talk. And currently, I believe we're the second search result, so that's exciting. Yeah, and right now it's easy to access. Anybody can, you don't have to create an account, nothing like that, so anyone can just download it and log in and check it out. Yeah, and we're very interested in feedback at this point, so particularly from teens, although a lot of adults seem to be also interested. So, yeah, any kind of like testing at this point is welcome.
You know, you're doing really amazing work, and clearly the United States is a platform for doing this work, but the platform is, the need is international. Maybe just in a minute, could you tell us, how do you think about this ultimately, maybe a year or two, three down the road, how culture and distance, does it change how you might approach this in other cultures? Or do you think this really is the need and you just have to kind of turn rotationally just a little bit?
Up until this point, we've spent a lot of time working with students in the U.S., and so I don't think that we have enough experience at this point to think that far ahead, although we have been approached by funders and individuals from around the world to ask us when this is coming to them. So I think that once we spend the next couple of months improving the app for teens in the U.S., we can think about turning towards that, and that would be something that would be very exciting for us to think about.
Yeah, I can just see it in some different languages, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exciting. As our conversation comes to a close, is there a final thought both of you would like to leave our listeners with?
Governor Roy Cooper has just declared that this month is Let's Talk Month in the state of North Carolina, so we greatly encourage everybody to talk about sexual health and sexual health-related topics in the month of October and beyond.
We want to thank you so much for being our guest. Thank you for what you're doing on behalf of youth and stimulating conversations and ultimately community.
Yeah, thank you for having
us. Thank you so much.
Thank you for being here, guys. Well, we've been talking with the co-founders of MyHealthEd, Liz Chen and Vichy Jagannathan, about Real Talk, the company's new app that uses teens' phones as a tool to tackle hard topics. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Michael Baca-Atlas.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Calls segment of our show today, I want to welcome a special guest for this segment, Dr. Warren Perry. Welcome for House Calls, Warren.
Hello. Thank you for having me back.
You know, it's great to have you back in your perspectives, particularly as an emergency room physician, a different perspective on the sorts of house calls that come at us, many of which patients could just as easily end up in the emergency room as they do in a primary care office. And we're going to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first house call today. It's on tuberculosis, and it's an emerging problem more recently than in the past.
Recently, a case of tuberculosis was identified at UNC, and the school sent out a warning email, and it was on the news. Was the general public ever really at risk? How common is tuberculosis, and how easily does it spread?
Well, it can spread pretty easily, particularly depending on how infective the person is. If someone has got disseminated tuberculosis, they got active TB in their lungs and they're coughing, people can be exposed? And I guess that's the biggest question. And, you know, I don't have that information about how infective this person was. I do know that there were more cases of tuberculosis in the last 2 years than there had previously been before that. But cases had been declining for 2 decades before that. I think we had maybe 10,000 cases, something like that, total in the previous year.
Yeah. Overall, at least like in developed nations, tuberculosis is not that common. And it has like 2 different forms. It can just be in your body, very latent and resting and sleeping, or it can be active, which is, I believe, the case you're talking about right here, where it was actively replicating in this person's body. In regards to, again, as of infectivity of it, I mean, I'm not quite sure about exactly what that is. It really, the risk to the public is really who that patient was exposed to and what environment where they were in. Because it's an airborne transmission of the actual bacteria. So it all depends, basically.
I know that sometimes, like, if someone has been on a airline flight, and exactly, that's where you might see it, and they've been, you know, and they found out someone was exposed, you might say, well, send out a note to everyone who was on that airplane flight. You can get their names and addresses and contact and call. Or you could send out a mass email that says, anyone who was on that flight, you know, call. And it maybe isn't either or. But I can understand people getting scared. You know, when we diagnose someone has a sexually transmitted disease, they get referred to, you know, the health department in terms of contact tracing that gets reported, and then phone calls get made to try to cut down. So in this particular case, I would hope that contact tracing could really occur and did occur. But there could be circumstances in which maybe someone really had a lot of exposure. They were in a lot of different places and people may not know that. So I don't think it's a bad thing, but I can understand people getting alarmed.
Yeah, I could too. And that actually happened. There was a guy on a flight who spread TB. I forgot. That was like a few years back.
Yeah. My very first case ever as a medical student, Warren, I was 3 hours with a patient who was coughing with fever and weight loss. And I didn't quite, as my very first patient ever, a third-year medical student, I didn't quite make, I thought, oh, lung cancer. I was concerned. I just knew it was lung cancer. And the attending comes in and the attending says, did you wear a mask? I was like, no, I thought he had lung cancer. He goes, no, he's got tuberculosis. Oh. And I just felt like such a dummy. And I had to take, I didn't have to take the medicine, but I did have to get tested for a number of months to make sure I never converted.
Yeah.
But I never forget that. Don't make that mistake twice. Laura, what's our very next house call?
I'm 78 years old, and the doctor who's been in charge of my care for nearly 35 years is retiring. Can you offer any reassurance as I try to find a new primary care physician at this point in my life?
Yeah, I'll make a prediction. You will not get another doctor that's going to care for you for 35 years. That'd make you 113.
But maybe.
It could be.
You never know.
You never know. But another thing I'll say is, if you had a doctor that cared for you for 35 years,
that's good.
That's great. That's not even good. That's great. Mm-hmm. Super. Congratulations. I would ask that doctor who they recommend.
I was going to say the same thing. I would make sure everything was in line, and I would ask the doctor, who would you recommend? If you're in my situation, who would you recommend for me? And that's how I would play this.
Yeah. One of the things you don't want to have happen is to go to another physician. You'll probably get a good physician because you're a doctor, or you'll know. You'll hopefully get a really good physician, but have that doctor leave in 2 years, 1 year. So I would ask the doctor before you go to see them, are you planning on being in practice for another 5 years? You can't ever, you know, promise this sort of thing. But, you know, if that doctor happens to be in their late 60s, maybe they're thinking about retirement. If they happen to be in their just out of medical school residency or out of residency, they may be moving some, you know. So maybe someone who's maybe in their early 50s. That's a good thing that, you know, I'm just making that up because I'm in my 50s, but not my early 50s. Good question. I hope you get great care. Laura, what's our very next house call?
I was just diagnosed with polycystic ovarian syndrome. What should I expect going forward as I try to manage it?
Well, polycystic ovarian is a really common problem that I think doctors are more aware of now. Maybe the public is more aware of now than we've been in the past. And, you know, we see women who are overweight. We see women who have amenorrhea. They're not having their menses. And we see those women maybe have some metabolic abnormalities, maybe they're diabetic or pre-diabetic. And then all of a sudden, a light bulb goes off and says, oh, this woman may have polycystic ovarian disease or syndrome. I think the earlier we can think about it, the more we can try to prevent the consequences of it, which are lots of cysts around the ovary that causes some associated syndromes.
A few things that the women who have this is due to the fact that they have androgens, excessive androgens running through their system. So a lot of women experience weight gain, difficult weight gain. A lot of women experience, becomes very hairy. So a term for that, I forgot what it's called.
Hirsutism.
Hirsutism. That's
hard
what I'm
word.
Looking for.
Excess hair.
Excess hair. That's the word I'm looking for. But it's all because there's hormones in the body that are driving these signs and symptoms. There's also, you have amenorrhea or you have hormonal mood swings. A lot of, again, like a syndrome goes on because hormones pretty much affect everything in your body, unfortunately.
And the diagnosis sometimes will be a blood test to measure testosterone levels, which is a hormone which should not be elevated, but would be in these women with the excess hair and the excess androgen, the hormone. Also, an ultrasound to really see these extra cysts. You can have excess elevation of blood lipids, high blood lipids in addition to the blood sugar. So the treatment is frequently weight loss is one of the major treatments, sometimes treating with medicines to kind of prevent the diabetes from happening. Mm-hmm. Or management would sometimes be useful. You know, it's not an easy thing, but I think a lot of times it can be controlled.
Yeah, and then as far as like the menstrual regulation, you can use birth control pills. So there's a lot of, again, pharmaceutical as well as just behavioral changes that you can make to help your quality of life.
Yeah. We're going to have our health sciences librarian, we'll put up some information about this polycystic ovarian syndrome, some information maybe about weight reduction, the medications to treat the lipids, and medications for regulation like the birth control pills. Thank you so much for that question. Alar, what's our very last house call?
I was diagnosed with depression about 18 months ago and have been in treatment ever since. Recently, however, I saw a commercial for a drug to treat bipolar depression, and I've begun to wonder if that's actually what I should be treated for. Is there a difference in how my doctors would approach my care if I do have bipolar depression?
Well, the short answer is yes. I mean, or maybe yes. It's, first off, this is a difficult condition, and a lot of times people who are diagnosed with depression that may not know that they're bipolar at that time because it's the depressive form at the time and they maybe haven't experienced the mania or that kind of that heightened sense of arousal that interrupts sleep and causes anxiety and someone gets pressured speech. You probably see patients in the emergency room treating and coming in with bipolar quite frequently.
Yeah, I do. I see it all the time. And I agree with you, Adam. I think that bipolar depression would most likely be addressed differently than just regular depression. And I think if you suspect it or you feel like there are other things that you haven't discussed with your doctor, you feel like, you know, by your research that you've done clearly that you might have some signs of mania, I think there, or but the bipolar, I should say, I think you should definitely go to your doctor and discuss those, be totally open with him or her. Because if it is bipolar depression, maybe that medication might help you better, or maybe some other form of behavioral therapy might help you than what you're getting right now.
And you might need more than one medication. The problem with taking an antidepressant if you have bipolar is it can actually precipitate or cause then the mania to come out. There are people with bipolar, but you might need the antidepressant as part of a combination medicine. Definitely agree with seeing a therapist, psychiatrist for that. Well, that'll conclude our house calls today, and we want to thank all of you and all of our listeners for joining in to Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns important to your health. You can send any question or story to us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our great guests today, Liz Chin and Vichy Jagannathan. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.